From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, New York Times reporters Jeff Gerth and James Risen invoked what they believe is their First Amendment privilege not to reveal anonymous sources. The wrinkle here is that those sources, presumably government employees, provided the erroneous information that led to scientist Wen-Ho Lee being smeared in print over allegations about the passing of nuclear secrets to China in 1999. Lee, who was held in solitary confinement for 9 months and whose reputation was destroyed, wants to sue for violation of his rights under the Privacy Act. In order to do that, he needs to identify the government agencies that spread the erroneous accusations to the press in the first place. To do that, he needs the reporters to identify their sources, but they don't want to, despite an order from a federal judge to comply. Lucy Dalglish, executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, says this court order is very dangerous territory, and she joins me now from Washington, D.C. Lucy, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you very much, Bob.
All right, so why is this territory so dangerous?
It's been about 30 years since the U.S. Supreme Court has directly confronted this issue. And in fact, in the last 10 years, I think we've only had 5 journalists sentenced to jail for refusing to release confidential source information. So to have 5 of them all at once in the same case, in such a high-profile situation, and they're all from major news organizations, I think it's a fairly dramatic case.
Yeah, the other 3 are not with the New York Times, but have been ordered to testify in the same case by Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson, correct?
Yes, they're from the Los Angeles Times, the Associated Press, and CNN.
Well, at the risk of asking you to belabor the obvious, why is it so important to journalists and to sources and to democracy for the privilege of confidentiality to remain alive?
Journalists view their duty to keep confidential information confidential the same way that doctors and lawyers and priests view their duty to keep confidential information confidential. You want sources to be able to feel that they can come forth, share information with a journalist, and that a journalist is going to act independent of the government or independently of any party in a lawsuit, and their only goal is to share the truth. The only thing a journalist can really rely on is the public's perception that they are operating independently.
Now, there is a body of law that in general supports the reporter's privilege, and a number of states have shield laws which explicitly protect journalists in situations like this. But on a federal level, there is no absolute right to journalistic privilege, is there?
No, there's not. The federal government has never passed what we call a shield law. It gives a reporter a privilege not to divulge information. Several federal circuits have recognized varying degrees of a privilege under certain circumstances. And in fact, in this case, Judge Jackson did consider the reporter's privilege. He said that Mr. Wen-Ho Lee's attorneys had exhausted all alternative methods of finding this information and said that the only course of action left to him was to order the journalist to testify.
This case is interesting and I think puts the issue in very sharp relief because it's not a case of a whistleblower telling tales on the government. It appears to be a case, or at least Wen-Ho Lee believes it's a case of the government unleashing its employees to smear a private citizen. And in fact, in his Los Angeles Times column, journalist Robert Scheer, who is unabashedly left of center, said that Gerth and Risen and the others should surrender their sources because if they don't, it will give the government license in the future to use their resources to harm its own citizens.
But in the end, if you allow the government to compel you to testify and identify your confidential sources, your credibility as a journalist ultimately is gone. And the result will be journalists and sources being far less willing to take risks on whistleblowing.
One final thing. I'm assuming that your absolutism on this issue doesn't deprive you of sympathy for Wen-Ho Lee. What do you tell Mr. Lee in these circumstances?
I guess I say, Mr. Lee, there are certain journalistic principles at stake here, and we are intent on behaving ethically. And just because you believe someone in the federal government behaved unethically and illegally in revealing your name does not mean that we as journalists should behave unethically.
Yeah, I don't think he's buying, but it makes some sense to me. Lucy, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Lucy Dalglish is Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press.
When Ho Lee was accused of telling secrets, the government is charged with creating far too many of them. Steve Aftergood, director of the Federation of American Scientists Secrecy Project, bird dogs the government's tightening grip on information in his newsletter Secrecy News. He says that while the United States is the most open government in the world, it's also the most secretive.
No other government produces new secrets at such a prodigious rate. More than 23 million new secrets in the last year alone. And part of that has to do with the enormous size of our military, the vast size of our intelligence bureaucracy, which dwarfs that of any other in the world, and with the result that we're just producing an avalanche of new secrets all the time. I think as a society, we somehow need to get a handle on this and make sure that we're keeping secret the things that need to be secret, because there are such things, but nothing more than that.
Let's review some of the big government secrecy stories of 2003. One of them is actually one that dates back to 2001 but has gained new life, and that's the controversy over Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, which we understand was filled almost exclusively with people from the oil industry, but we'll never know for sure because he wants to keep that list secret.
That's right. I don't think the vice president is trying to hide the fact that he had a meeting with the Sierra Club. But it's an interesting case because, unlike many other controversial aspects of government secrecy, even the government does not claim that there is a national security interest here. They are simply saying, we don't want to tell you. This is a position they adopted prior to September 11, and I think it tells us a lot about the attitude of the Bush administration towards public disclosure.
And where does that case stand now?
The Bush administration has appealed to the Supreme Court to intervene in the case so that it does not have to disclose the kind of information that a lower court said it must. This is the subject of a lawsuit brought by Judicial Watch and the Sierra Club. The Supreme Court will hear it next year and make a decision.
Another big story from this year is the famous missing 28 pages from the joint report on 9/11. Now, this was the report that was supposed to look into intelligence failures, our inability to predict that attack. Now, this does have something to do with national security. Do you think it's valid that those 28 pages were redacted?
Well, this is, a really interesting and representative case because the authors of the report, members of Congress, have argued on a bipartisan basis that most, not all, of those 28 pages should be declassified. And yet the Bush administration refused, and Congress, I think, to its disgrace, did not put up much of a fight.
That does seem to be a problem. Congress seems to have been rather passive with regard to fulfilling its responsibility for oversight.
That is definitely a problem, and it's also a problem for citizens and journalists who would try to understand the workings of government.
What was the story this year that was most influenced by the wheels of government secrecy in play?
Well, undoubtedly, the decision to go to war in Iraq is the most dramatic and most consequential instance of government secrecy at work. You know, not only was crucial information withheld, but false information, whether knowingly false or otherwise, was introduced into the mix. I think it's an object lesson in how the quality of the deliberative process has begun to deteriorate. It's not that, you know, strongly held views should not be aired. So obviously they should and must, but the opportunity to critically evaluate them was lost, and we embarked on a path to war largely in the dark.
In a war against unwarranted government secrecy, Dana Priest of The Washington Post recently called you an army of one. Is that how it feels for you?
Oddly enough, the answer is no. There are a growing number of individuals and organizations who recognize that this is a problem in their own domains, whether it's journalists or historians or environmentalists or ordinary citizens bumping up against the wall of secrecy. Early in 2004, there's a new coalition that's about to be unveiled under the aegis OpenTheGovernment.org, which is a broad coalition of diverse organizations who share a common concern about growing secrecy and are determined to try and correct it. So it's actually not lonely. It's a tough slog, as Secretary Rumsfeld put it in a different context, but it's not lonely.
Thanks very much, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen Aftergood is director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy and publisher of the newsletter Secrecy News.
Two American soldiers were killed in Baghdad on Monday. Glenn Allison of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and Charles E. Bush, Jr. of Buffalo died, coalition officials said, in a bomb blast near their convoy. Their deaths were duly noted in the New York Times on page A-10 and in the Washington Post on page A-16. The inevitable moment has arrived. American deaths in Iraq are no longer necessarily front-page news. They've been relegated inside, noted almost perfunctorily next to ads for Dell computers and the government of Kazakhstan. Normalized, in other words, made routine. Glenn Allison and Charles Bush gave their lives for their country, and their country will scarcely notice because we're used to it. This sad passage isn't an indictment of journalism. It reflects only journalism's ability to document truth even when it isn't trying to. In this case, war's terrible capacity to render us unshocked by the shocking.
Next up, media dispatches from Haiti and Pakistan and the Queen's annual holiday headline.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf continues to score points with the Bush administration as America's key ally in the war on terror. But despite his popularity abroad, Musharraf is in deep trouble at home. The opposition has mounted a fierce movement against the general remaining in uniform while president, paralyzing the parliament for almost a year. Many are skeptical about his commitment to democracy, but even they agree the press has had more freedom under Musharraf than probably ever before. Even so, the press there walks a careful line through a minefield of military, political, and religious influences. From Islamabad, Miranda Kennedy looks at the press in the first of a two-part series on Pakistani media.
Traditionally, the Pakistani print media has had more space to breathe than the electronic media, no matter who's in power. That's largely because it is less effective. Of a country of over 140 million people, only some 2 million read newspapers, thanks to shockingly low literacy rates. and English language papers account for only a fraction of those readers.
It is almost an indulgence of the elite in this country, the English press.
M. Ziauddin is the Islamabad editor of The Dawn, a sober and respected English language newspaper that was actually founded before Pakistan itself. Ziauddin says The Dawn survived decades of military dictatorships basically because it shamelessly towed the government line. Ziauddin recalls printing verbatim government press releases and letting the censor board remove entire pages. The Dawn can write whatever it wants these days, but that's because hardly anybody reads it.
The governments of the day became aware that, look, if they leave the English press alone, that's not going to make much of a difference.
Even if the government largely leaves the English language newspapers alone, individual journalists aren't always immune. Najam Sethi, editor of the Lahore-based English newspaper The Daily Times, was thrown in jail under two earlier Pakistani regimes for his work as a journalist. He lived through the era when journalists were actually flogged as punishment for penning critical views. Najam founded his first paper, the Weekly Friday Times, after Pakistan's fearsome Islamist former president Mohammad Zia-ul-Huq died in 1988. Najam says that under Musharraf's government, the press is better off in many ways.
Everywhere he goes, he flaunts this to the Western world. The press is free. And to a large extent, that is the case. Unless there was extreme provocation of a personal nature against any of the generals, Musharraf basically let the press be. Musharraf has tread a very careful and balanced line. Selective repression, targeted, but without leaving any fingerprints. But by and large, the press is free.
The targeted repression Najam Sethi talks about has been well documented by the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. They say there have been dozens of attacks on journalists just in the last year. Last January, a journalist who wrote a book condemning religious fundamentalism was killed. Recently, another journalist who criticized the government's sports board was badly beaten. Mehdi Hassan is a Human Rights Commission board member and a journalism professor in Lahore. He says these violent incidents prove that the media in Pakistan is still inferior to that in neighboring democratic India.
In Indian society, there are people, there are newspapers which condemn religious extremists against Muslims. In Pakistan, you can't condemn and you can't agitate against the doings of religious extremists and religious parties openly.
Najam Sethi has a different take on the Indian versus Pakistani media. While he agrees that democracy is necessary for media to thrive, he thinks it often leads to an aligning of the press with government and business interests, what he calls a democratic leveling. This is what's happened in both the U.S. and the Indian media, he says, because when you have an established democracy, reporters tend to fall into line based on consensus. So according to his analysis, there is an upside to recent decades of media repression in Pakistan.
We've been under a lid. And when they took the lid off, we were so angry that we started sort of, you know, shouting and screaming. And the rules of the game in terms of what you can say and what you can't say and why not are not entirely clear. So for that reason, precisely because we've been under a dictatorship, and when you take the lid off, there tends to be a bubbling over. We are still very bubbly.
Pakistani newspapers are very lively, both in English and Urdu, the national language of Pakistan. Irshad Haqqani is a senior editor and columnist at the Daily Jang, the largest Urdu newspaper in Pakistan. He criticizes the Musharraf government regularly in print.
Although there are invisible pressures, there are behind-the-scenes moves, but by and large, even if you criticize him personally, you don't think that you will be prosecuted or a case will be registered against you. But I can't say that everything is hunky-dory, everything is fine. They are bringing new defamation laws, which are more stringent than the ones that are already there on the statute book.
New laws proposed by the Musharraf government would impose new restrictions on journalists accused of defaming or slandering politicians. Critics point out that the law against blasphemy is used to settle personal scores and often targets journalists. In July, a Pakistani high court sentenced Munawar Mohsin, a junior newspaper editor, to life in prison for allegedly defiling the name of the Prophet Muhammad. It's a capital offense in this Islamic Republic. President Musharraf promised he would reform that law when he came to office. Pressure from Islamic fundamentalists made him change his mind. But even so, Asma Jahangir, Pakistan's best-known human rights lawyer, sees some murmurings of hope for a free press.
Previously, people were too scared even to discuss the law of blasphemy. And then there was a demand that this law should be looked into. And now you see newspapers writing about it. You've seen editorials denounce the manner in which it is abused. I think we have tasted a few months of relative freedom, let me put it that way. And it's very difficult to reverse it, number one. And number two, of course, it is another century, and you have to go forward.
But accompanying small signs of change, there's caution. Editors, journalists, and academics admit they censor their own work for fear of running afoul of the country's blasphemy and defamation laws. Pakistan still has a long road to travel towards press freedom. For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Islamabad.
The Associated Press reports that on December 18th in Haiti, police stormed a pro-opposition radio station, smashing equipment in what they claimed was a search for weapons. And while President Jean-Bertrand Aristide says he favors a free press, some 30 Haitian journalists have chosen self-imposed exile after receiving threats in the past 2 years.
Meanwhile, Haitian radio journalist Michel Montas, the former director of Radio Haiti International, was honored this month as a defender of press freedom by the watchdog group Reporters Without Borders. Her husband, journalist Jean-Dominique, was murdered in 2000, and she was forced to close the radio station and leave the country after mounting threats on her life. Bob spoke to her in March, soon after she closed down Radio Haiti.
We realized that the danger was not just on me. The danger was on everyone. I did it because I felt that we had to protect lives. We have lost 3 lives in 3 years. That's a lot. I was no longer willing to go to another funeral, and we decided that the only way to stop this right now was just to stop broadcasting.
You have reported, and your late husband reported, on corruption in the regime of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This regime was supposed to be the democratic alternative to the years of repression under the Duvaliers, but some things, I guess, in Haiti never change.
That's true. A few things, of course, have changed to the extent that we don't have censorship the way we did when we worked under Duvalier at Radio Haiti. We don't have open repression on the press on the part of the government as we did during the coup, which was from 1991 to 1994. However, now we have forces, people in the streets, armed people, who think that they can, you know, force anyone into silence. If a journalist says anything that they don't like, they can threaten that journalist, and there will be no punishment to them. So it has been really kind of an open season against not only journalists, but against anyone expressing ideas that are against the party in power.
There are other radio stations in Haiti, perhaps not as significant politically as Radio Haiti, but they're nonetheless. What are they doing with you off the air? Anything more substantial or just status quo?
We know that there is a radio station where they have started counting days. You know, for the last 3 years, I've been counting days. Every day I've been saying good morning to my husband, every day counting the number of days since he was assassinated. And they have picked up since we stopped broadcasting. One radio station has started counting, but the other way around. It has been 1 day since Radio Haiti had to shut down. It has been 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and they keep it up. You know, radio journalists feel very endangered by the fact that Radio Haiti had to close. It is a symbol of the situation that most journalists face because of a general climate of threats against the press. The idea is that if you break the thermometer, maybe you will change the temperature. And you have right now a level of self-censorship on the part of a number of journalists who feel that they cannot say what they used to. And in fact, when I think of the type of journalism we were doing at Radio Haiti, investigative reporting, I don't think there is any room right now for investigative reporting. I remember recently we covered the story of one congressman that had been assassinated by a known gunman, and it touched people close to the party in power. And right now, I don't think any station could do it.
I want to change the subject a little bit. The director, Jonathan Demme, has made a documentary about your struggle, and particularly your late husband's struggle. It's a film called The Agronomist. Your husband, Jean-Dominique, was trained as an agronomist. He became a journalist only later in life. But the film isn't about agronomy.
Well, it's about not only the struggle of a man for democracy. I think it's the struggle of the country for democracy. And he has covered the years from the 70s when, Radio Haiti was on the air until now. And the whole story is about the love of a man for a land, for a country. And that's why he kept the title The Agronomist.
I'm going to ask a difficult question. I don't mean for it to sound indicting, but I must ask it nonetheless. If this film, The Agronomist, is about a movement and a people who refused to be intimidated, how should we regard the irony of the possibility that the film will debut for world audiences and Radio Haiti won't even be on the air to speak about it?
Radio Haiti stopped broadcasting from 1980 to 1986. We went back on the air then. We went back on the air again in 94 after stopping to broadcast for 4 years. We haven't stopped fighting. I think our silence is a way of fighting. The fact that we stopped broadcasting is putting pressure on the government to an extent that is maybe even more important than actually speaking out to the extent that right now they are going to be forced to come out with indictments in the case of Jean-Dominique. So I don't think it is...
So the silence is deafening.
It is. It is. I think it's louder than words.
Michel Montas, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Michel Montas is the news director of Radio Haiti and the widow of Haitian journalism martyr Jean-Dominique.
Almost every year since 1932, the reigning British monarch has addressed the nation on Christmas afternoon. It started on radio with King George V, the present Queen's father. Now Queen Elizabeth II's Christmas message is heard on British TV and radio and on many other networks around the world. And for the first time ever, Her Majesty is offering a telephone hotline so that troops serving in Iraq can hear her on their cell phones. But in recent years, viewership has drifted downward to below 10 million from a record high of 17 million back in 1987. Gareth Mitchell filed this report from London in anticipation of Christmas Day.
As I look back over these past 12 months, I know that it has been about as full a year as I can remember. But Christmas itself still remains a time for reflection and a focus of hope for the future. All great religions have such times of renewal.
As is the custom, the monarch referred back to the year just gone and then went on to reflect on the Christian significance of Christmas. For Matt Wells, media correspondent at The Guardian, the annual broadcast serves at least one obvious purpose.
The Queen doesn't have much contact with her subjects during the year, apart from the occasional walkabout and appearances on television. She certainly doesn't speak to them very much. So it's the one opportunity for people in Britain who have little contact with the monarchy actually to hear the sound of their voice. And I think it's this slightly odd nature of the broadcast that makes it such a strong tradition.
That strong tradition goes back to the broadcast's early days when it was an opportunity for the monarch to talk to the British Empire. Though most of the empire has gone now, the Queen's former spokesman, Dickie Arbiter, says the sentiments of the address, largely based on values and spirituality, remain much the same.
At the end of the day, this is a Christmas message to the Commonwealth, and there is the religious aspect to it without ramming home the idea of Christianity. It's also a sort of look back on the year, of some of the highlights of the year, and with television they try to bring in the pictures of some of these highlights.
Filming footage from royal tours to include in the Christmas message is a fairly recent innovation. Until about 5 years ago, the Queen simply addressed the camera. In recent transmissions, the Queen has treated viewers to glimpses of Windsor Castle, and she's tried all kinds of TV techniques usually reserved for the slick media professionals, a royal effort to craft must-see TV, and to be sure that it is...
The Queen's Christmas broadcast is shown at 3 o'clock on the two major television networks in Britain. They take it in turns to produce it and show it at the same time.
Guardian media correspondent Matt Wells.
So it's one of those very few leftovers of patrician Britain where the broadcasters almost tell you that actually now you have to sit down and watch this.
And for those viewers who consider the Queen's message the television equivalent of watching paint dry, there is an option.
Channel 4, one of the more subversive British broadcasters, doesn't broadcast the Queen's Christmas message. Instead, it broadcasts an alternative Christmas message, as it describes it. It invites controversial or interesting figures from the year to come and give their take on Christmas.
The contents of the Queen's broadcast are always a closely guarded secret. By sweet-talking Buckingham Palace, I was hoping to bring a scoop to On the Media, but sadly to no avail. Uniquely, the Queen's words in the Christmas message are her own. Just about everything else she utters in public is prepared by the government. The personal tone and its strict embargo is always a welcome Christmas gift to journalists manning the country's otherwise quiet newsrooms. Matt Wells.
For the British newspapers and the British news broadcasters, the Queen's Christmas message gives them a bit of a handle on Christmas Day. And indeed, in recent years, the Queen's Christmas broadcast has made the top of the headlines. So it is still very much a talking point.
But who's going to be tuning in this year? Well, I thought the Kensington area of London, close to the former home of the late Princess of Wales, would be a good place to canvass some opinion from the streets as to whether the broadcast is a must-see Christmas Day event. Will you be watching the broadcast this year?
Absolutely, yes.
Why is that?
It's the thing you do every year, so gotta see the old girl on TV. Absolutely, it has to be done.
I think it's on at the wrong time during the day.
Right, so it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's not convenient for you.
It's not, no.
I normally do tend to watch it, but don't really pay that much attention. It's just a traditional thing of just moving wallpaper, I think.
Do you think it's a good thing that it still happens, though?
It's part of tradition, and she is still the monarch of the country, after all.
Well, the nation might be shrugging its shoulders now, but the telly event will be watched, as usual, by millions. But that's just us British view. I mean, it's not as if we celebrate the fact that the Queen's head is on our currency, but talk of replacing it with the euro, and we suddenly come over all patriotic. So, whilst it's true that there might be a collective glazing over of the eyes across Britain at 3 p.m. on December the 25th, to even think of a Yuletide without the Queen's speech, well, it's just not cricket, is it? For On the Media, this is Gareth Mitchell in London.
Coming up, a pitiless look back at television's recent past and television composers race against the clock.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's Christmas weekend, a time for family reunions, spiritual contemplation, and for a lot of us, watching television. We asked Time magazine media columnist James Poniewozik to ring out the old year with a look back at TV in 2003. James, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, one word or phrase to describe the year of television 2003.
Desperate, I'd say. Desperate in the sense of the television business is in tough shape, as has been well reported through the fall. A lot of the reality shows that we've seen this year were born of a problem TV has, which is how do you get people talking to each other about television, feeling that they really need to see it. This is something that TV sitcoms and dramas used to do. I do think we also saw some examples this year of fiction TV learning from and adapting some of the techniques of reality television, quote-unquote. The Office, which was a great import sitcom that came over from Britain, was a sitcom shot essentially in a mockumentary style with sort of, you know, confessionals and interviews and a lot of the devices that we're used to seeing in TV reality shows like The Real World and whatnot. We've also seen a new development in what you would almost call like a scripted reality television with shows like The Joe Schmo Show, which on the one hand was a reality show. It was about a guy who believed that he was a contestant on a reality show called Lap of Luxury, but in fact, all of his fellow contestants were actually being played by actors who were all in on the joke. And this was a show that was, in its way, as scripted as any comedy. It was essentially the first really effective reality series parody of a reality series.
A reality TV show that works by trading on a total unreality. I refer, of course, to the Ali G Show, which briefly took paid cable by storm. What's the future for tricking people into appearing on news-like shows only to be made a fool of?
I think that there's a booming future in it. I mean, that was really another one of the big threads that we saw in television just across the board this year is the theater of deception, not just the Ali G Show, which was a great, clever, and knowing way of applying that to a news-type show, but, you know, also Punk'd. A lot of reality competition shows like Average Joe and Joe Millionaire and so on and so forth were essentially about deceptions of one kind or another. You know, I know that with the Ali G Show in Britain, they eventually reached the point where they felt that they just couldn't continue doing this as well as they could before because people would, you know, ultimately be in on the joke. But there seemed to be just myriad, endless ways that you can deceive Americans, and I think that TV is going to keep coming up with new ones.
And the very fragmentation that's destroying the industry gives Ali G a big advantage in the United States, much bigger country, television, much less of a national shared experience. He can probably keep this going for years.
Exactly. I certainly think that that's one of the ways in which fragmentation has sometimes helped the quality of television.
So in a way, a byproduct of the desperation by the major networks is an opportunity for niche players who don't have to play to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think cable has had a very good year. This was the first year, for instance, in which even during the November sweeps, when the networks are, you know, rolling out their most promoted, biggest shows and specials, more people watched cable than watched the networks. And cable had a much better year than the networks did creatively, certainly on my end-of-the-year top 10 list, and I think on a lot of television critics, you're going to see a lot more cable shows represented than the networks. And I think part of the reason is that the smaller cable networks, although they're owned by the same evil multinational corporate monoliths as the big networks, they're managed differently. Everything that they do is not necessarily focus grouped to the same extent, and they're allowed to take more risks and just throw more things at the wall and see if they stick.
James, well, listen, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks, Bob.
James Poniewozik's wrap-up on the year in culture can be found in Time Magazine's Person of the Year double issue, and his top 10 list can be found on time.com.
TV inspires so much passion that amateur critics may find that they're talking about it all the time. Take Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano, who first met each other in an internet chat room devoted to Beverly Hills 90210. Soon they were posting their own wrap-ups, as they were then called, of a new and even more self-consciously terrible show, Dawson's Creek. Eventually, they launched TelevisionWithoutPity.com, known to strike fear in the hearts of TV producers. The site currently recaps 37 shows, each one updated weekly by a recapper assigned to that beat. Sarah Bunting joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, for the uninitiated, we should give an example of what a recap actually is. It's brutal. One might even say pitiless. And this season's Survivor is being recapped by Miss Ali, who clearly loathes a contestant named Rupert. Here's a clip with some recap.
Over at Rupert's Gradual Descent into Madness, he is chopping away at the outside of a coconut or something. This is the outside, he snarls to an observing Krista.
So much rot and death here.
Or, quite possibly, to some invisible people who you and I and Krista cannot actually see.
Rot and death.
And he says it with total, absolute, grim seriousness. He really does have a screw loose, no kidding. It's sad and kind of not that funny. Okay, it's sad and funny.
Now, Television Without Pity's roster of TV programs is very heavy on reality fare, and it has dramas, and it has no sitcoms. What determines what makes it onto your site to be recapped?
Well, initially, we selected a range of shows, most of which were on the WB and would be the kind of teen pap that Dawson's Creek had been when we launched with only one show. But then we were immediately crossed up by The West Wing, which we added because we thought, Rob Lowe, come on, in a White House drama? You've got to be kidding. And then it turned out to be this wonderfully written, critically acclaimed show that brought masses of people to the site. And at that time, we felt that we could expand the mandate to things like HBO's Sunday Night Dramas on the thought that if people are watching it, surely there are comments to be made, even if they're not derogatory.
On the site are forums where viewers can post their own responses to the shows and to your recaps. Do you get the sense that they are always in on the joke as you present it?
Well, initially, when the site was smaller, there was a sense that everyone understood. But as the site has grown, there are times where arguments over the phrasing of a certain insult on the real world devolve into these semantically charged things that you just think to yourself, push back from your desk for a few minutes and go get a Diet Coke and just breathe deeply, because it doesn't matter enough to be yelling at other people. But then again, I've done it myself.
Last year, the New York Times Magazine featured a very flattering story about your site called The Remote Controllers, about how Hollywood scriptwriters and producers read and use the information in the recaps to adjust storylines or drop characters that aren't popular and so on. Is that true?
I really hesitate to overestimate our effect on storylines, on characters. We've seen some little minor ripples, like characters being named after recappers.
And you've gotten even more direct reaction than that. The Times reporter Marshall Sella recalls that Aaron Sorkin, the creator of the drama The West Wing, was so stung by comments on your site, he wrote a rebuttal which you posted. And then, says Sella, in a later episode of West Wing, Sorkin depicted internet users like yourselves, presumably, and I'm quoting the Times here, as obese shut-ins who lounge around in moo-moos and chain smoke parliaments.
Yeah, I don't know where he got that. I smoke Camel Lights. We found that delightful. Petty, but if it was us and if we had irritated him so extravagantly that he would light out after us in a nationally broadcast episode, we thought, wow, that's fabulous.
Generally, you guys seem pretty impervious to charges of nastiness. As it says on your homepage, spare the snark and spoil the networks.
Yeah, I guess we are. I think the meanness, at least on my part, comes from this constant optimism that television is going to be good, that it's going to fulfill its potential the way Buffy did for several seasons, the way My So-Called Life did, the way The Sopranos has done, that you realize it is possible for television to be important and to be a cultural through line, but there is also an element of laziness in a lot of television. And I think people accept that because television is like the redheaded stepchild of the arts.
So what do the recaps contribute to the culture, do you think? I mean, let's face it, people don't need to read 15 pages about Joe Millionaire.
I find myself answering questions about our role in the culture and where we fit in the feedback loop. And I feel like I should cite Marshall McLuhan, but I don't know where. It really is simple in the end that we're just sitting there making fun of these things and feeling superior about our intellect a lot of times.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Bunting is one of the founders of Television Without Pity.
As we've heard, reality TV shows dominate the medium. And while the writers have it easy, the composers are madly scrambling. The reason? Reality shows demand quicker turnaround than other TV fare. The time between shooting and airing can be as brief as a week, allowing almost no time for post-production. Klaus Andreasen, freelance reporter for Swedish National Public Radio, met with television composer David Vanacore, who sometimes has but a couple of days to write the score for a one-hour show.
David Vanacore is the award-winning composer for shows like Survivor, For Love or Money, and The Restaurant. But in his studio, housed in a single-family home a few miles north of Los Angeles, he works alone. And dwarfed by the banks of synthesizers, samplers, and computer hardware is his sole musical instrument, an electronic piano keyboard.
Yes, with the, you know, the new technology, I only need one keyboard. Everything else is synthesized, sampled, programmed in a sense where, you know, I am playing everything from the timpani to the flute to the oboe to the clarinet. You know, you name it, there's a sample for it.
Solo cello ready to go, and this cello happens to have a lot of different things. It's called key switching, so that's a cello with vibrato. This is a short. Here we have, this is the same instrument without changing it. I'm key switching pizzicato.
With the birth of motion picture came the solo pianist in the orchestra pit, enhancing the silver screen action. With modern television series, the image of a musical lone wolf has come full circle, the musician taking on the role as composer, orchestrator, and sound engineer as well. But it didn't always used to be that way. John Burlingame teaches the history of film music at the University of Southern California, and he's also author of TV's Biggest Hits.
In the heyday of television scoring, which would be the 60s, the 70s, and the early 80s, in fact, it was commonplace for a full orchestra to be playing every week behind most one-hour shows. When I say full orchestra, I'm talking about at least 25 musicians, possibly as many as 50 or 60, depending on the project. Two things happened. One was called Miami Vice in the mid-1980s. Because Miami Vice was the first hit show to have an all-electronic score. That was a hit. That told producers immediately that you could create these scores on a weekly basis on a much smaller budget. And I think the second thing is the explosion of cable in this country in the 1990s, whereby there were so many shows, so many options, so many places to find your entertainment, really led, cut the budgets really down to nothing.
But there are actually still a handful of shows that use a live full orchestra.
Yeah, the Star Trek shows actually have an orchestra of 35 to 40 players a week. The Simpsons uses an orchestra of 30 players a week. And the military drama show JAG.
What about the composing? Is the music on today's television shows as good as it was 10, 20, 30 years ago?
In my opinion, no. Not quite. Because in that era, you had amazing people making music for television. Practically every important composer in 60s television has gone on to a stellar career in feature films. John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, Lalo Schifrin. In most cases today, the time frame within which a composer has to fashion a score has really shrunk. There's so little time and so little money to execute. An important facet of the television viewing experience. My hat is off to composers working under these conditions today.
Which brings us back to David Vanacore.
We get our assignment. We have about 4 days to actually compose new music for the show.
Wait a minute. You have 3 or 4 days to compose how many minutes of music?
Usually with Survivor, it could be as much as 15. It varies from week to week. You know, I've had as much as probably 15 and as little as 3.
David, when I arrived this morning, you were working on something. Tell me, what was it?
It's a very sort of dramatic orchestral cue that is going to be scored behind a plane sequence where there's beautiful scenery and flying through mountains. And so essentially, it's the anticipation of the takeoff, into the takeoff, into the telephone. Hopefully it's not them waiting for the piece of music, which essentially happens quite regularly.
Despite the wide array of musical options in a synthesizer, for a divertimento composer like David Vanacore, the ringing telephone is probably the most motivating instrument in the room. For On the Media, I'm Klaus Andreasen.
And happy days are here again.
That's it for this year's shows. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Is everyone out there singing? If you are, then it's sure that happy days are here again.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Happy New Year!
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.